Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to the Newtown Theatre. Please welcome a man who was sick to the death of disgusting audiophiles. Here's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello. Welcome. Welcome to Richard Herring's Last Shitting Thursday podcast. I'm very happy to be doing this. Don't you worry. I love being here. Though I was hanging around with all the nominees for the Perrier Awards. No, they don't call that anymore, do they? All the nominees for Dave's Best Comedy Show at the Pleasance Awards. And they call it Relastopus. I don't know if that's going to catch on. Good to see the Pleasance doing well. It's nice to see the Pleasance. Accident. I've been at the Edinburgh Fringe for too long, right? I know that now. I passed a homeless man in the street the other day. He had a sign saying, I need £16 to get a room in a hostel. And I thought, how the fuck did you afford that? Where did you get that deal? Should be giving me some money back, mate. Do you know how much I'm paying to stay in this city? I thought, I've gone it's too far. I don't know. I took his money, but it was gone too far. And yeah, the audiophiles keep complaining that the volume of the people at home who are not paying for this, so fuck them. They're saying that the noise changes to volume, James, depending on who's talking and what we're going, and that I should normalise. We should normalise it. You cannot normalise what you do, you audiophiles. You're disgusting. Discuss what they do to sound, and sometimes fresh new sounds that have just been made. And get away with it. It's disgusting. The news in today, I saw on the front page of Chortle, which is kind of the Common Comedians website, Emily Hudd says they're talking about comedians getting onto TV. She says some comedians don't have the right kind of audience to get on TV. This is your fucking fault, you wankers. This is. I just want to be on the telly, and because of you, you're not the right kind of audience. Brought me down. If I was working in TV, which I would be if it wasn't for you fuckers, then I'd be more worried about all the people who aren't watching TV that they don't have, because it's a dead medium. Good. So. Get in a podcast, guys. You're all going to be doing it soon. So, look, we're going to crack on, I think. Yeah, why not? We managed to get over 100 into the house. I didn't think we were going to get over it. There's only been one show that's been under 100 people in the audience. 2nd of August is still the chittest date of all the dates I've had. Right, my first guest. So, well done for being over 100 people. My first guest today is probably best known for her work as being camera assistant on Crapston Villas. That's why we've all come out today. Will you please welcome the incredible Susan Murray, ladies and gentlemen? Susan Murray. Come in, welcome. Hello, sit down, pick up. There's a mic there, it's all nice.
Hello.
Water, we thought of everything. How are you doing?
I'm really good, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm all right. In fact, I was just saying to you backstage, 2 years ago at this stage in the Fringe, I was doing my show, Oh Frig, I'm 50, and I would walk from this end of town to the Pleasance, and when I got to the bottom bit of the Pleasance, I had to sit on a wall for 5 minutes, because I genuinely didn't have the energy to walk up the hill.
So everywhere's uphill, even when you're going down, it feels like it's uphill, and I live at the bottom of the hill, so no matter what I come into town to do, I'm sweating within 10 minutes. I'm always covered in a film of sweat in this city, even if it's warm. If it's not warm, it's raining, so you just always, how's Edinburgh? It's brilliant, but it's damp, every 24/7.
Yeah, so I'm sweating. But I'm still managing to move around. So I think I'm in a better place than I was 2 years ago.
A bit fitter.
A little bit fitter than I was 2 years ago.
Do you think you get fitter from being in Edinburgh for a month?
Well, you can do. I think I've got a little less fit than the start of Edinburgh, because I've been eating a lot of, like, cakes. I've stopped eating chocolate and I've stopped drinking, but in Edinburgh I've started eating. My daughter likes donuts and I keep eating her donuts.
And also, when you're doing lots of gigs around, you're sort of eating on the hoof a lot of the time. You just think, I just need to put something in me for a bit of energy. Yeah. And we're not doing drugs anymore because we're this age, aren't we? Oh, God. It's a shame, really.
It is. It is. But there we go. Well, you know, we're still young, Susan. We're still very young.
You're kidding nobody, Richard.
Tell me about being the camera assistant on Crapston Villas. Do you remember the show Crapston Villas, ladies and gentlemen?
It was Channel 4. It was at 11:15. It was specifically designed for people coming in from the pub. And I was a trainee camera assistant, not a proper camera assistant. And it was stop frame animation. It was an adult sitcom. And it was really good fun. I discovered that I preferred working with people who'd graduated from art college than the people that... Because I did media studies degree. What a pointless waste of time that was. And they were sort of quite spotty on that. Nice, but a bit spotty. And I preferred the kind of slightly more anarchic arts graduates, but I can't draw for shit, basically, so I became a camera assistant, and it was really good fun, and that's how I started stand-up, because the woman who wrote and directed that, Sarah Ann Kennedy, her sister had done a stand-up course with Hattie Hayridge.
Oh.
So she told me about the stand-up course at Jackson Lane Community Centre. Yeah. You know the one?
I think I did it for a little while,
I was taught by Tinky Winky. Dave Thompson taught that course. So that's how I came to do stand-up, basically from working on Crapston Villas.
Yeah, he was the original guy inside Tinky Winky until he got sacked for being too perverted, I think.
What, wandering around naked and smoking hash out of a pipe all day, I think. We might have to edit that bit out, not sure.
We'll leave it in, see what happens, it's not our problem. and this year's show, how many shows have you done in Edinburgh, like full-length shows?
Solo ones.
Yeah.
I did The Glottal Stops Here, which was about accents. Great title. I did Photo Booth. I also did Fuckwit Club, and this is my fourth one.
Because you've been doing, you're very established on the stand-up circuit around the country. And again, we had Rich Wilson on the other day. Again, there's another kind of more middle-aged comedian who's sort of come to Edinburgh a little bit later on in his life. You know, it's because a lot of club comedians are quite snooty about Edinburgh or just can't afford to do it.
There just seems to be two different worlds, doesn't there? There's the kind of like the because us circuit comics, the ones who earn a living throughout the year, look at all the Edinburgh comics that have been nominated for the awards and go, "What do you do the rest of the year? I don't see your name listed. I never work with you. I don't know who you are." And we just can't. We don't quite get it.
No.
It's like there's like a secret society that we're not allowed in because we're too common. So yeah, it's bizarre. And like, I did listen to the Rich Wilson podcast, yeah. And he was it was interesting that he was saying that, because I'm doing free fringe, and I'm living with two people who are doing paid fringe, and they're both just like, I'm coming in counting money every day, and they're both going, I wish you'd done the free fringe now. Oh God, I'm going to lose so much money. Even if you sell loads of tickets, you can still lose loads of money, because any people who make money out of this festival of the council, the landlords, mostly the landlords, the bars, the hotels, and it's the performers that lose money, and like we're just getting shafted left, right, and centre. It's like a big corporate gangbang, isn't it? But it was interesting what he was saying, how you kind of, your status goes up if you do the paid fringe as opposed to the free fringe. And that's just one person. Do you think that's true?
I don't know. I don't think it matters really either way. I think, you know, both for your health of mind and body, it's nice to know you're not losing loads of money. If you're doing a show and losing loads of money, which I've done some years, many years really, that makes you depressed if you're losing.
And then you're not going to do a good show if you're depressed.
No. So it does. I remember when I was doing that year, I lost 45 grand putting on a play, and my stand-up show my stand-up show didn't do as well as usual because it was on later, and I didn't get, so I thought, oh, the stand-up show will mop up some of that debt, but it didn't. And I remember, like, you know, I was behind the curtain about to go on and do quite an energetic show, and Christine Riley was in that show, and I would be just like ashen face, but the minute I threw the curtain, I really made the effort to not let it show.
Consummate professional.
So I did, but he literally said, you look so, you know, before you go on, you look so unhappy, and then you go through, and then you know. But I did enjoy doing the shows. But yeah, I mean, I don't think, I think it's about creating the show, and the thing with the club circuit is really real comedy. The guys doing the club circuit year in, year out, that's what comedy is. A lot of people doing Edinburgh are trying to move on to something else, you know, especially now. There's no, you know, you might be trying to move on to tour your shows, I guess, in bigger theatres. Mm. But if you're managing to stay working in club comedy your whole life, then that's the proper job.
It's the best dead end job in the world.
But it's, you know, it is. I think I was thinking about it, it's a sort of admirable thing, and there's a lot of guys. And when I started, there weren't many middle aged people doing stand up.
So there's nothing else for us to do.
No.
But how do you? What career change can you do when you're 50 and you've been a road dog comic for 20 odd years? You know, wrecking cars up the country because you're doing, putting so many miles on the clock.
Yeah.
What else can you do?
No, nothing.
I like the fact, but I do like that, because I just think, well, I don't have to do anything else, because we're all just growing old, you know. So there's still people who are older than me, and there's still people who are younger. I'm kind of like almost like directly in the middle. Well, I won't always be, but you know what I mean. Yeah. And I quite like that fact. So
yeah. And again, but just when I saw it, there wasn't, you know, the circuit had only been going for 10 years or so. So there wasn't, you know, I mean, Bob Boynton might have been the oldest person on the circuit then, and he was probably 35 or something. You know, when I was
35.
You know, so
it's not Logan's Run.
I was 20. But it's interesting. And it's part of the problem, I suppose. It means that there's all these established acts who are still working and not moving on, because there's thousands of comedians. So those new comedians are coming up here, probably coming up here because they can't get the work.
But do you think they're not moving on because the media, i.e. TV and radio, are pretty ageist? Because you never see any new acts under the age of 35 on Live at the Apollo, unless they're already established.
Yeah, it's very rare. It's very difficult to break.
Yeah, because agents only seem to be interested, young and new. That's all they're really bothered about. And if you're vaguely competent, you get propelled really quite quickly, I think, now. And because there's a lot of sort of more mature lady comics, like me, Mandy Knight, Mandy Muden, Mary Bork, you know, all really like cracking quality comics. I include myself in that. And you know, people say, oh, well, maybe you missed the bus, but there wasn't a bus to catch when we were doing it, because there were so few vehicles for comics. And now they're just not interested in any woman over the age of 40, really.
Yeah, I mean, that TV might change. You know, I think what TV hasn't realised is that young people don't watch TV.
Yeah.
So what they might go, oh shit, we need to get some of the people who actually are the same age as the people who watch TV on TV.
Maybe. I don't know. Seem more optimistic than I do.
Well, I don't really want to go on TV anymore. I mean, that's the thing. I think you make your own. I only want to go on TV. So that's my shtick, is that I'm only let me back on the telly. But in reality, between you and me, you know, why take this? Why people say, why don't you put this on TV? And if an amazing deal came through,
isn't there a small part of you that thought about getting a chat show on TV?
Well, no, you think about it before, but then it's, again, how do you make that leap? But then also, it's much better doing this. I'm not convinced. I don't think I'd get paid anymore for doing it on TV. I wouldn't own the idea. It would get edited by someone else. It would get changed by someone else, and it would be restricted in terms of time and content. So I don't think there'd be really any advantage to it at all. It might, unless you're like literally on BBC One at
10 o'clock.
Well, the thing is, that thing of you'd sell more seats on tour because you'd just be
maybe. I'm not sure because it would be something. It would be like on a terrestrial, a satellite channel, wouldn't it? Most likely.
Aim high, Richard.
If they said you're going to take over from Graham Norton, yeah, maybe that might help. But I don't think that would be Yeah, I don't think that would be a good move for me. If I asked Ben Affleck if he's ever tried to suck his own cock, maybe it would. Maybe it would. He definitely has. There's video on the online. Let's talk about this. Yes. He might have someone else who'll do it for him. No, maybe not. This year's show is quite a controversial idea for a show. So it's how not to die in a plane crash, which is not that controversial.
It's quite tricky because you can't write jokes about actual death, really. No. And I do state in the show that I'm not trying to take the mickey out of anyone who's died in a plane crash or anyone who's got loved ones who's died in a plane crash because, you know, I am human.
Yeah.
And every time there's a plane crash, I'm the same as everyone else going, oh my God, those poor people.
Yeah.
But then I'm addicted to a show called Air Crash Investigation, and I just think, oh, God, that's going to be a really good episode. I can't wait for them to make it. When are they going to make that one? Have we got any fans in of Air Crash Investigation? Oh, they're always into it. And the thing is, if you're into it, you're really into it, aren't you? Brilliant, isn't it?
I mean, it is. Well, because, you know, it's that fascination and that with your own fears, you know, and everyone gets on a plane and thinks it's going to crash, even though that statistically it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
And, you know, those, when you do... it's one of the, it's like when you watch on YouTube and someone's walking on top of buildings, you know, and they're filming themselves, and it makes me feel physically sick. It makes my shins hurt, but I can't look away from it, because, you know, that's one of the worst things for me, being on top of a building, walking around. But I can't, you know, I can't look away from those... When you get into one of those transcripts or whatever
it's Air Crash Investigation is the jewel in the crown of like, you know, plane crash porn, basically. Yeah. Of the horror. And the thing is, you can watch it knowing that you're safe on your sofa. That's the best thing about it. I'm really safe.
Well,
slamming into a Japanese mountain. I'm having a great day.
Some of the planes crash into buildings, so you're not 100% safe. Might be that'd be the irony if you're watching that. The worst one, and I don't know if you've covered this, the one that I keep going back to and that makes me feel sick, but also, I mean, it's almost funny, but it's absolutely terrible, is when the pilot of a plane, the transcript of the cockpit thing, and he lets his son have a crack on the
he took
on
his
the
kids.
Joystick.
He must have had the kids. Oh, sorry, guys, it's my turn to have the kids for the weekend. Yeah, because we've all done it, haven't we? We've all gone to work with our dads and crashed a multi-million-pound machine into a mountain. Yeah, I can't talk about, because there's people always say, oh, did you talk about this one? But yeah, I can't fit them all in, because there's too many amazing, I mean, terrible, I mean, brilliant, I mean, awful plane crashes. And I can't physically fit them. That's why I quite like to tour it, because I'd like to be able to do more, because they've all what about Tenerife and, you know, all these, you know, the all-time classics.
But it's
you
sort
can't
of like
fit
that.
Them all in.
I mean, because it's sort of, I mean, if it wasn't that hundreds of people had died, it would be quite an embarrassing story to tell, right, wouldn't it? But it's that thing where he lets his son fly the plane and then the plane goes into a spiral and crashes. But what's going through your head as you go, you're thinking, oh, fuck, my wife's going to kill me. All these people
again.
Are dead. and oh, fuck, I've got to get out of this. It's just the absolute, as a parent as well, you go, that's
the worst. Do you want the actual details on it?
Yeah, go on then.
Okay. So he brings his kids on, and it's against all regulations, and he lets the little girl sit in the pilot seat, and what the pilot does, he adjusts the autopilot and goes, just turn that a little bit, so she thinks that she's flying the plane, right? And of course she isn't. So then they get the boy in, and he's 15, and because boys are fucking idiots, right? And he does a similar thing, and he pulls the controls too hard, and he partly disengages the autopilot, right? So then the plane starts to bank, and there's about five people in the cockpit, and the first person to notice it happening is the boy, and he goes, "Should the plane be doing this?" And you go, "These other guys are trained, and you're not trained. How come you were the one to notice?" And then there's a discussion for like about a few. They're going, "Oh, are we in a holding pattern?" And they're like, "What are you doing? There's three yeah. pilots, and they still can't work it out." Then they finally discover. Then the plane starts banking downwards, and the co-pilot, he can't get to the seat. And then the autopilot disengages, and then it starts. And then the computer system flicks in, and it goes up again. And so it's partly them just not noticing, and the computer half working, and then they manages to get into the seat, and then he overcompensates and brings the plane up virtually vertical. So of course it stalls and goes down again in the corkscrew. The pilot manages to recover amazingly. So like they think they're going to die twice, and then they've lost so much altitude they slam into a mountain. I don't talk about that in the show, by the way.
I mean, it's terrible. But you know, it's fascinating as well, isn't it? That's the.
It's fascinatingly gruesome, isn't it? And the thing in the show, what I've had to do, because it's hard to write, you know, jokes about actual plane crashes, because we know people die, don't we? So I've had to put like just tent poles in of jokes in between them to sort of make the show just, you know, not people with their jaws on the floor, just horrified, walking out, shaking. So it was quite a sort of challenge. How do I make a show funny about plane crashes? So that was it was really interesting, you know, doing the actual writing, and of course I love the research. 3 o'clock in the morning, oh, another air crash investigation, brilliant. So yeah, I've really enjoyed doing it.
And do you have advice on how to avoid dying in a plane crash? Is that
I've got loads of tips. Loads.
Don't get on a plane.
Yeah, swim. I think my favourite one is take your own bomb. Because what are the chances of there being two people on a plane with a bomb? It's not going to happen, is it? No, so I've got some genuine ones in the show, and I've got some really daft ones as well.
Yeah. We had, do you know the Victoria Coren story? We had Victoria Coren, who was very afraid of flying, and went to a therapist to help her cure.
And then months later, he died in a plane crash.
He died in a plane crash. Yeah.
What was it? What was he thinking as he was careering to the ground? Oh, I'm such a hypocrite. But they can't ask for their money back.
Well, it's, you know, wonderful light topics like this that keep us going. And what's how we doing? Oh, yes, we haven't got too long. Well, let's talk a bit about the Red Imp Club. You set up the Red Imp Club in Walthamstow. It's one of the best clubs in London.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a terrific club.
Do you know the reason I set up this club in Walthamstow? Mainly because I wanted practice at emceeing. Mm-hmm. Because unless you've got a residency, it's a different thing, isn't it, emceeing on stage? It's a different muscle. It's kind of a different skill set. And unless you keep doing it on a regular basis, it's kind of hard to keep that going. So that's the only reason I ever started the gig. And it's just sort of grown and grown and grown. And now I've got people like you that come and do it. And I've got Stuart Lee in September doing 3 nights. So my locals in Walthamstow are just like, they're amazed that all these people come to Walthamstow and don't get stabbed.
Well, you do a great season of Edinburgh Previews, which is very useful for comedians as well. But it's a great club to try, because it's always full, but it's also it's an audience of people who've seen enough comedy that they get one.
They're a good comedy crowd. They're a little bit like there was a gig in Crouch End that was always, it was like, it's the same demographic that used to be before all the bankers and like hedge fund managers moved into Crouch End. So it's the same demographic. It's all like teachers and social workers and artists and journalists. A really nice mix of people. They're very Radio 4. But you know, they're a really good crowd. And it's Zoe Lyons, his favourite gig to do, and Omid Jalili comes back and does it a few times a year.
Yeah.
So people ask me to come and if they can come and do the gig, because it's such a nice gig to do. So that makes my job a lot easier, doesn't it?
So it runs all year, doesn't it?
It's generally a monthly gig, but if acts want to come and do an extra gig, if the room's free, I just bung it in.
Well, look out if you're in Walthamstow, look out for that. It's well worth going. And you organise the comedians' Christmas party as well.
I've been organising the comedians' annual Christmas party for about 10 years, and we have it in January. You're not invited. It's nice, actually, because it's a Tuesday. No one ever works in January on a Tuesday. Venues are like, please come and spend loads, because we drink loads of alcohol. And it's really, because it's a bit like being in Edinburgh, but without the stress. How many did you have in? It's like, how was your Christmas? My family, I wanted to murder my family. Me too. Let's get drunk. It's that kind of thing.
It's interesting because comedians, often when I was talking to Tommy Tin, who was on yesterday, and like, you know, I've never actually gigged with Tommy, and I've met him once, and just in Edinburgh in the street, and before, and that, you know, you've worked in the same job for 20, 30 years and never bumped into each other anymore. And that's weird with comedians.
That is bizarre.
Some people you see all the time, and some people you just gig with once every 15 years.
Yeah.
It's lovely to go to Edinburgh, and that party is a great way to. But what I like also about comedians, I was talking to Ed Byrne about this, is just even if you haven't seen a comedian for 10 years, you basically, there's something about comedians where you just sort of slide back into wherever you were before.
It's like being in an army regiment, because you've been through the same shit.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a bit like being a firefighter. You don't know what you've been. You weren't there, man. You don't know what you've been through until, you know, it's this, because that's how you connect, isn't it? Like, we've all had terrible gigs, we've all had terrible agents, you know, we've all had awful drives, and it's, you know, you bond on the negativity, don't you, really?
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's hard for comedians. Some comedians have said, you know, it's hard to, when you're just meeting your partner's friends or whatever in dinner parties, it's a bit boring and weird.
It's a bit dull, isn't it?
And it's really hard to, because people are asking you about being a comedian and it gets boring, or they're just. It's a weird thing that kind of. I mean, it's why this podcast works, really. It's because comedians
can just get the best thing my boyfriend did this year, he said, I said, do you want to come up to Edinburgh? And I said, don't come up the first week because you're getting into the swing of it. And he said, shall I just not come up and leave you to your Edinburgh bubble? I went, oh, I love you. You're amazing. And I've told quite a few of my girlfriends. They've gone, oh, he's brilliant. Because it's just a pain in the arse when you and your mates come up and your family come up. Like, no, I've got to deal with you. Because you're just working, really. You're just kind of trying to get in the swing of it. And they just interrupt it.
Yeah, and by this stage as well, when people are turning up now, you're kind of ready to die. And
unless you come in with £1 million in used banknotes, just stay away from Edinburgh.
Right, let's ask you a couple of emergency questions. This is one I've been asking everyone recently, so I'll ask you. You may have heard it if you heard the Richard Wilson podcast, so maybe you thought about it. If you could have one item from any art gallery or museum in the world and get to keep it and it's yours, what item would you take from any kind of anything?
Have you heard my accent? What art gallery do you think I go
doesn't
to?
Doesn't have to be art gallery.
I don't even go to Wolverhampton Art Gallery. I think it's a Wetherspoons now anyway. I just go to the ones at the Wetherspoons. Well, it's obviously going to have to be the Mona Lisa because it's worth the most money and it might just pay me half a month's rent in Edinburgh Festival.
Good, yeah, good choice. Let's see what comes up randomly, Susan. It'll probably be about air travel. And everyone will feel sick again. Do you secretly wonder if you are the new Jesus?
The new Jesus?
Yeah, the new. I mean, he's going to come back, isn't he? I mean, you know, so the same Jesus, but...
Secretly wondering from the new Jesus? Yeah. My ego's just not that big.
Yeah, a lot of comedians, I think, would do. I think Donald Trump seems to have got there.
Maybe if I took enough decent drugs, I would.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of psychosis, because apparently that's what you write a show about these days, and then you get 6 million stars for it. Psychosis, sexuality, feminism. Yeah.
Not air crashes. That's not going to. They're not going to give you an award.
That's not on the list of awards, apparently. Yeah. Saving people's lives. 45 people by 40. That's how much many my venue holds.
Right, one more. Let's see. I'll go to a different page. Here's another do you ever secretly wonder question, coincidentally. Do you ever secretly do you ever wonder, this is for children, this question. Do you ever wonder if secretly you're a prince or princess and that you'll one day take your rightful place on the throne? I mean, probably if you're not, don't think you're Jesus, you probably haven't thought that. Do you think you might be a secret child of Diana, Lady Diana? Probably not Lady Diana.
I don't think the dates work out, do they?
Princess Anne, maybe. Princess Margaret. You could be Princess Margaret.
I've got such low self-esteem. I once... Does anybody remember a comic called Mandy? It was a little girl's comic. Along with Twinkle. That's how old I am, Twinkle. And there were always stories about orphans in a workhouse, and it turned out they had a twin sister who was still living with the family. For some reason, they've given one kid away, even though they're loaded, right? And she's in a workhouse, and the other, and they're getting like telepathic messages. And I actually demanded to see my birth certificate when I was about 8 years old, and I was really disappointed I wasn't adopted. Oh, I thought I was going to have better parents than you. Now look at me, stand-up comedian with low self-esteem.
All right, here's a new emergency question that I came up with yesterday. I might have written this one before. It's ripped off of myself. What is the biggest animal that has bitten you?
The biggest animal that's bitten me?
What have you been bitten by?
Do humans count?
Yeah, I mean, possibly. If there's
I got bitten
bigger.
At a gig once.
Did you?
Yeah, by some mad woman at a New Model Army gig.
Not one of your own gigs. So in the crowd, someone just bit you?
Yeah, somebody bit me in the middle of a mosh pit.
Wow. Some people do that, don't they? I mean, my son does that. I think you're allowed to when you're 18 months, but it's annoying.
I don't think she was teething at 40.
No. Some people do have that kind of compulsion to bite.
I don't like big animals. I'm scared of horses. Yeah.
That would give you a nasty nip.
Yeah.
They are scary. I've seen them up close now because I live in the countryside now. There's horses next to my house.
Do you live in the countryside now? Why do you live in the countryside?
Because I can look at horses closer and see how weird they are. Because I've got children. You have to take them out of the city in case there's a nuclear attack. In case a plane crashes into your house. Although we're right under the flight path for Luton Airport, so we're probably taking
it. Oh, plane spotting, brilliant.
Yeah.
So if it comes down, hope you've got life insurance.
And, a subsidiary question, what is the biggest animal you have bitten?
Bitten or eaten?
Well, I mean, I did consider whether I would allow you to choose... eating them as part of biting.
I mean, who bites animals?
Well, I was,
are you that hungry? You can't wait for it to be killed and cooked.
it would be a way to find out if you've bitten an animal. What's the biggest animal you've eaten?
What's the biggest? I think it's probably just a cow. No, it's probably a horse, isn't it? Because we all know the horse beef scandal.
Yeah, we've all eaten a bit
of
horse.
And the thing is, I don't know why that was a scandal, because you go, well, horse meat is better quality than cow meat, so why is everyone complaining?
True.
And it probably tastes nicer.
True.
Yeah.
People have weird affections for certain animals that they feel you shouldn't eat.
So if you, suppose if you ride it, you're not going to eat it. Dirty nod, yes. Fanar.
I've eaten a crocodile.
Have you really? Yeah. I don't go for exotic foods. I'm a bit of a vanilla kind of wimp. Yeah. I don't even like spicy food. I'm all right. I don't even drink coffee because I think it smells like heaven and it tastes like a puddle.
Oh, it's good.
I'm a horrifically fussy eater. I can't eat cheese if it's melted on toast.
What?
No, makes me gag. I'm really...
What about pizza? You can't eat pizza.
I don't, it's mozzarella because it's really weak. Okay. It's sometimes, if I have crackers and cheese, this is so weird, I grate the cheese onto the cracker and Marcus Brigstock goes mental because he thinks I'm a real scumbag. You don't eat cheese like that. Well, that's how I eat it, sorry, because if I have it sliced, it makes me feel sick because it's too strong. I'm such a wimp. I'm pathetic.
Good. See, we found out a lot about you asking if you've ever bitten an animal. Right, well, tell us about your show and where it is.
My show is called How Not to Die in a Plane Crash. Who wants to learn how not to die in a plane crash?
Yeah.
Some of you are going to die, because not everyone's... why would you not want to?
So, in 100 people, what's the chances? What's the proportion of people who die in
one in 11 million, apparently.
Okay. So 100 people, probably none of us.
Yeah, probably going to be all right. I went on a Fear of Flying course, and shall I sum it up for you in the style of Harry Hill circa 1997?
Yeah.
For 3 hours, they basically said to us, what are the chances? That's what they said for us. Paid £300 for that. 4:30 at Banshee Labyrinth every day from now to the end of the Fringe, really. I think I finish on Sunday.
Terrific.
So, yeah, 4:30 if you want to come. Oh, you have to get there a little bit early because it's very popular. They're giving out tokens and they start those from 3:30.
Okay. Great. Ladies and gentlemen, big round of applause to Susan Murray.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. See you soon. Lovely to see you. Thanks. Right. Oh, how are you doing? You having a nice time? Good. It's all right, isn't it? My son's drawn, and my son's helped me with the notes today. He's scribbled all over my book. Bloody idiot. Can't read what I've put. As always, just remind you that you've got a free programme here in the theatre before the show. That's a gift, and you don't have to give anything for it. If you feel like making a donation as you go out, I make a collection for Scope, which is a fantastic charity that I'm a patron of that helps people with cerebral palsy. It's trying to get equal rights and access for disabled people. So if you see a bucket, please put some money in. If you feel like doing, you don't have to. Or if you can't find a bucket, I will be sitting in the foyer after the show trying to sell my last remaining copies of Emergency Questions books. Two different ones, a big one with 1,000 questions, a small one with 500 questions. They cost the same. And there's a very limited number of stickers as well. If you buy both books, you get stickers. You can buy the stickers on their own, but I've only got 3 sheets left, so be quick. I'm very happy to sign your programme, say hello, and do selfies and all that stuff if you want to say hello after the show. And if you're listening at home and you've enjoyed these podcasts, why not go to gofasterstripe.com and buy those books as well, and then that will be your payment for listening to these podcasts for free. And then you can complain about the sound quality. Okay, that's the deal. So let's crack on. Do give some money to Scope if you feel like doing, you can do that at home as well, of course, in the usual way.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Right, my second guest today is probably best known for doing a stand-up show with a robot. At least that is all I found when I read that. That was all I was interested in. And that is all we're going to talk about. Will you please welcome the amazing Alice Fraser, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
That's my pleasure. Thank you for coming along.
It's my pleasure. Oh, and it's my job.
I saw you in the meadows. We passed each other in the meadows, very near to your post. I don't know if you stand there.
Yes,
so
I
you
do.
Can go.
That's where I live. I can't afford rent in Edinburgh, so I just build a little hut out of my own posters.
Come out. That'd be quite cool, actually, if you just came out of your own face. So let's talk about robots to begin with.
Yes.
So you did a show where, what kind of robot did you
Well,
have?
The premise was it was a double act with an AI.
Okay.
So I just wanted to do a technical show, really, because I'd done these three shows, the trilogy, Savage, The Resistance, and Empire, which were all kind of me gutting myself on stage.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to do fun, silly, double act with a robot, very easy, just 117 sound cues. And it was not well received.
Was there any... I'm quite interested in robots for lots of reasons. Was there any sexual tension between you? Was there any caste romances between you and the robot?
There was no... No, in this... I was sort of the father of... It was sort of
okay,
a Frankenstein story.
That's
I was the father of the robot.
You're allowed to build your own robot and fuck it. That's part... That's one of the... That's the fourth rule of robotics.
You know, dildos aren't recyclable.
No.
They're terrible for the environment.
Okay.
Every orgasm is a dead dolphin. Think about it. Like,
it's
you know, they're not recyclable. You can't get them secondhand. I mean, you can, but you wouldn't.
So is it cheating? If you have a partner and you have sex with a robot, should that be considered cheating on your partner, or is it fine?
I think it depends on the volitional element, whether if you believe the robot is a person, if you've attributed it with... it's the hard problem of consciousness.
It is, yeah.
So that I think once philosophers have resolved that,
yeah,
then you'll have to stop fucking your robot.
Okay, but until that day, until it's not... But
look, hey, don't ask me for permission. If you want to fuck a robot, man.
My wife says I'm not allowed to, but I'm trying. If you said that I was allowed to, that would be a big help in my case. I don't want to fuck any of them yet. They're not sexy yet. But when they get sexy, I'm not kind of interested in... when they get properly sexy like they are in the TV shows, I might want to have a crack.
Yeah, those are actors.
Yeah, I know, but when they've got that technology, which can't be far away, it's getting closer every day.
I mean, arguably, you could just fuck sociopaths.
Yeah, that's true. See, I think that's you've crossed the line there. Even if not so much they're conscious, it's more what you are considering, isn't it? Whether you think it's the deal.
I've never turned my mind to this problem, no. And I'm very confused
that
you have turned your mind to it
How
so hard.
How could you have not had done a whole show about robots and not done most about fucking them? That is insane. The people who make robots are fucking them. What do you think they're making them for?
Have you seen those Boston Robotics creepy ones?
Yeah.
They're going to murder you in your sleep. That's not sexy.
You've got to start somewhere.
Unless you're into vampires.
Okay. All right.
Or giant mosquitoes, as I call them.
You haven't helped me. I'll move on.
Please do.
So is it that your new show is called Mythos?
Yes.
Because you did Ethos and Mythos. Is it going to be part of a trilogy again?
I don't know. I left it open for myself to do that. Yeah. Yes, possibly. We'll see.
When you do an Edinburgh show, you kind of think, I hope nobody else... does a show like this. If you're doing a Brexit theme show, you think, oh, I hope no one else comes up with my Brexit pun. You must have thought you were pretty safe with the Mythos title, that no one else is going to do an Edinburgh show called that.
Yes, I did think I was pretty safe. I did know that Stephen Fry had a book.
Right.
I thought, yeah, but it's a book. It's obvious. You'll Google it and it'll be like, his is a book, hers is a show. They're very different people. Right. And then he decided to bring his trilogy of shows called Mythos to the Fringe, and I assume there's a lot of very confused people in his audience wondering why he isn't me.
Have you had anyone come that you can't have done? Even no one could be that stupid enough to come to the wrong Mythos.
No, I can't imagine that they would be. And no. If they have, they've been polite enough not to challenge
me. And if you're going to a show called Mythos, you're clever enough to work out.
I wonder if they think I'm like Tape Face franchising it out. Or
you don't look anything like Stephen Fry. It's terrible. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in the show. I haven't seen the show, but I've read a little bit about it, and it's in this show you took... I mean, I'm very interested in conspiracy theorists and people who believe in conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people who don't believe Australia exists.
Yes, that's kind of the centrepiece of my show at the moment, is I had an argument with a man online who didn't believe Australia was real.
Yeah.
And I was in Australia at the time.
Were you, though?
But... This was the thing of I was born in Australia, brought up in Australia, I know Australia, and yet I could not defeat this man in argument because it's sort of all this stuff of like, well, how can you prove it? How can you prove? And that's kind of a central question for me in everything is like, I'm not sure of anything. I'm never sure of anything. No. And I think that's a good ethical position to have, but in the context of an argument with a man who doesn't believe Australia is real, it's not a useful position.
It's interesting that, I mean, I've got some acquaintances on Facebook who've gone quite full-on conspiracy theory about a lot of things, right? And so there obviously are times when conspiracy theories are proved correct.
Yes.
But there's a sort of attitude behind conspiracy theorists that they're the only ones who are clever enough to...
I think it's such a hopeful idea of the world that anyone has their shit together enough to... Like, have you ever tried to get, like, a planning permission for a gate... Just the whole of our society is a delicately balanced tower of people's conflicting incompetencies. How can you imagine just like a worldwide conspiracy of people who all agree on a plan?
Yeah. He doesn't believe in this guy doesn't believe the moon landings happened.
Yes.
Which again, that's, you know, there was a quarter of a million people involved in the program to do the moon landing.
Well, I think it's this thing. They did this very interesting study at Yale on what the Dunning-Kruger effect. That if you tell somebody, say, do you know how traffic lights work? They'll say, yes, I know how traffic light work. And then you go, explain it to me step by step. And they absolutely realize they have no fucking idea how traffic lights work. We have that bias of thinking we understand things that we don't.
Yeah.
And you go, well, it could be this and it could be that. And we're very good at building, like we draw patterns in the stars. We, you know, we see faces in clouds. We're very good at projecting meaning onto things that have no meaning, as I showed in my robot show. I think it just because it could be, they're very drawn to the possibilities of what might be.
What I love is the sort of attitude of, I mean, they've all got that attitude of, you know, I've got this, but all the sheeple haven't seen through, but I'm clever enough to see through it. They don't think, you know, they think they've seen through to the world government or whatever it is, but for some reason the world government who control everything are letting them prattle on about it.
I would argue that there are very few, I wouldn't say none, but very few people who are heavy conspiracy theorists who have ever been above a middle management position in any kind of organisation. You just realise how nightmarishly crap everyone is at everything.
Good, yeah. Well, you know, you could be wrong. I've been to Australia, but how do I know it wasn't just all actors on a soundstage? I mean, there was a big soundstage because I drove right to the middle of it, but it could be just the Truman Show. Someone's really gone
just
to a lot of trouble.
Just people running alongside your car holding bad bits of scenery.
Yeah. Like a Scooby-Doo cartoon. No? Okay. Right, fair enough. And I saw you talking about men. I was doing a bit of routine about hormones and men saying, you know, women can... You were very funny about women and men, about hormones. The men who say women are ruled by hormones and
yes,
obviously men are.
I had this an argument with a friend of mine who's very right-wing, and I sort of keep him round to pretend I'm not in a liberal bubble. He said, yeah, women are hormonal and men are rational.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you... You know men have hormones too, right? And if you don't believe men have hormones, go wait outside at a pub on a Saturday night. Just wait for two men to come out having a fist fight about something neither of them cares about. And I like to go up to those men and be like, a bit hormonal, are we? A little bit testerical? Then you have to run. It's important you have to run at that point. Everyone has hormones. I just think, you know, I have an app that tells me, you know, when I'm going to want chocolate and cry irrationally. You guys don't know why you do anything. Like, everything in male human history was built on boners and spite.
Yeah. Don't. Well, I think that out of everything I've seen this Edinburgh, which isn't very much, but I've been watching a lot of things to, you know, research the show, but I've not been out very much because of my stupid children. But the thing that got to me the most was Jen Friedman, who was on very early, interviewing the McAfee guy, John McAfee, is it? The guy who did the virus software. And the way just she very mildly, this is a very powerful, rich man. She's a very pretty, attractive, clever woman. And she mildly flirts with him, like to compliments him on looking younger than he is. And it's a very, and he's the immediate change in his demeanor. You kind of go, that men can claim that they're not affected by hormones when a man that powerful can literally just have a woman. He should go, well, she's just interviewing me, so she's saying that to try and get around me. He literally takes off his sunglasses, like, oh, okay. You know, he's like, that is the change. So one of the most powerful men in the world, just a woman says, you look younger than I thought than you actually are.
Yeah, it's amazing. Insane. I think, and I have this in my show, and I think one of the problems about this kind of hierarchy and power structure and all of that, I think men don't value themselves highly enough. I really don't. I don't think men, as a general rule, have good self-esteem. They might have bravado, they might have arrogance, but I don't think they love themselves. And I use as an example in my show the stories of Zeus, mm-hmm. the king of the gods, who thought he had to trick women into bed.
Yeah.
Zeus, the king of the gods, was like, what have I got to be? I'll be a swan. Let me tell you about my Bitcoin investments. Like, someone might like you for yourself, mate.
Well, you just get a lot of misinformation about what women like as young men. So a lot of people say, like, that women love dangerous birds. So, you know, that's what he's got that.
Women love people who can only be eaten by the queen.
Yeah.
Also just the way I grew up with a twin brother, so I was surrounded by teenage boys in my teenage years, this sort of thing that they have that they get taught of, you have to impress or dazzle or bully, and that I think is the real sliding scale of how far you're willing to go to, you know, trick or dazzle or bully or push or pressure a woman. It relies on this assumption that you're not good enough in yourself for someone to actually like you. And the way I think about it is particularly that blowjob mime that you'll see young men particularly doing. They're like, blowjob mime. Joe Rogan does it as well in his... I like watching Joe Rogan specials because he talks about really interesting ideas in a really boring way, and I find it inspiring. But just that idea that the kind of the blowjob is degrading, or the flip side of like, oh, thank you so much. It's like, how much of a piece of shit do you have to think you are that you think someone doing you a favour is degrading to them? You don't think someone giving you an ice cream is degrading to them, and you have to lick your own ice cream.
But I think, I think men, we've talked about this a little bit, but I mean, we're brought up in such a way. So the reason that Zeus feels he has to trick women and have sex with him is because as kids, as young men, you're sort of taught that women don't want to have sex, or that sex is an amazing impossible. And you feel it as well as a young man. You feel, I'm never going to have sex. I'm going to somehow have to persuade or, you know, encourage or whatever a woman to have sex with me. And if people just educated about it, honestly, that obviously human beings want to have sex, that's a human imperative.
I think it's a terrible injustice that's done to young men, the idea that they are undesirable and they must pursue, and also to young women, that they're not taught, they're always taught that they should protect themselves from men, and they're not taught at all that they might themselves at some point feel desire.
Sure.
And so they're given no tools to manage their own desire, which means you see this particularly in America or puritanical societies where someone's like, oh, I want to get out there. I want to engage with the opposite sex. And they don't know how to do it. They don't know how to admit it to themselves. And so they go out and they make themselves vulnerable, which is not to victim blame. It's just saying that they don't know how to go. I mean, you need to go, yes means yes, no means no, maybe means maybe.
Yeah.
Like, why don't we just see where this goes? You don't. You don't get that. It's such a weird injustice, I think. Yeah. Sorry to get real, passionate about this.
We're allowed to get passionate. I think it's a central and very interesting subject, because if people were educated about it, men and women, young boys and girls, it's just, we're made to think that sex is something shameful and weird and has to be won or whatever. And it's, you know, it's I don't know how you overcome that, because it's obviously centuries of religious guilt that
John Hastings has a great joke about that, of like the idea that blowjobs are the best thing ever. And he's like, I've had two sandwiches that are better than any blowjob I've ever had. One was in Milton Keynes. I love that joke so much.
Must go to Milton Keynes. So you got into comedy quite an unusual route. You were a corporate lawyer.
I was, yes.
So what prompted you to make the switch from corporate law, which I don't even really understand what that is?
It's a nightmare.
Okay.
Is what it is. No, I did comedy at university. I did sketch comedy and improv, mainly because I was terrible at it. And I was one of those kids that was like quite good at school without trying, except at maths, and then I just didn't do that. Like, I just didn't do things I wasn't good at. And I got to university, and I was like, I don't know if I know how to learn anything. And then I did comedy. I did this improv thing, and I can still feel the full body hot flush of shame at how humiliatingly bad I was at it. And I thought, this is something that I don't care about, that I could get good at. And then I got addicted to it, this idea that you have to fail to get anywhere in comedy. You have to fail again and again and again and again. And I love that, because it means I'm not a natural comedian. I'm not naturally funny. Everything I have in this industry, I earned.
Yeah.
And that's a really satisfying feeling.
Okay.
Because that idea that you're like, oh, you're really good at whatever, English, or that's crippling. The idea of being sort of talented but lazy is, yeah, you can't do anything with that. That's not useful. But like, comedy, I know I'm shit at it, and now I'm good at it.
Through working at it. So you did suffer. Were you in the Cambridge Footlights, or you just worked? You were at Cambridge? You went to Cambridge?
I went to Cambridge. I did all the smokers. Yeah. And I sort of worked with them. I don't know what... I wasn't what, in the tour.
Who's
the
your? Touring. Who are your contemporaries at Cambridge? Are they successful?
People? Yeah, relatively. Yeah. It's Chris Lander, okay, who is now an agent.
Okay, yes.
Abby Tedder, Lucien Young, that kind of the sheep, all of those boys.
Yeah, yeah. So you nice. You did some student comedy, then went to work in law, and then thought, I'll go back to comedy.
Yeah, no, I was still doing, I started doing stand-up, so I went and worked in an investment bank in the US as an intern, being right. paid just no money, and I was super miserable and super depressed. I'd walk down the river listening to the Bugle podcast.
Yes.
And just hating my life. It was just so underpaid, so sad. And I started doing stand-up then, because I had no one to work with and I didn't have the energy to make friends to do sketch or improv. And then I kind of got addicted to not having rehearsals after that. So that was where I sort of started stand-up. And then, like, it was really fun going from being, like, listening to the Bugle, listening to audiobooks, and now I'm on the Bugle.
Yeah.
And I do audiobooks. And, yeah, like, that's one of those... You don't get promotions in this industry, but sometimes there are little milestones where you're like,
No, so you do a lot of podcasts. I mean, I don't know why you do so many podcasts. It's ridiculous. Too many. It's like you podcast everything in your life. It's ridiculous. So I was listening to the Tea with Alice.
Yes.
So is that your main...
That's my podcast. That's what happens when no one's telling me what to do.
Yeah.
I hoped it would be funny, but it's not. It's me talking about difficult ideas with interesting people.
Yeah.
Things. So I just feel like in the world today, there's too many people certain. And when you see an argument, it's person A arguing against person B. No one ever changes their mind. No one ever goes, actually, now that I say that out loud, it sounds like bullshit. You don't see that process happening. And I think that's worrying and dangerous, because people don't have a model for how to go, here's something I have no idea what to think about. Or I used to think this, but I'm starting to change my mind. And that's what it is. We have tea, we talk, it's fun. I like it.
That's good. I agree with that. I think like the problem is everyone's so set in what they believe now. I mean, it is probably social media that's created this. But if we're going to get anywhere with any of these problems, there's got to be some compromise. And yet being seen as being inconsistent or changing your mind is seen as being a weak thing, I think, for a lot of people.
Yes, and there's this attitude towards somebody else's argument. I think this feeds in also with the conspiracy theory thing.
Yeah.
If you treat the structure of somebody else's argument like a house of cards... So you're like, well, that doesn't hold up, and then the whole thing has to disappear. Whereas I think you should really, in good faith, if you're arguing, treat it like a Jenga tower. Yeah. Pull that out. I don't agree with that. Does it still stand?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a much more useful thing. And go into an argument going, where can I concede? Where can I say we agree? Where are you right? yeah. or where can I see what you, where you're coming from? Because otherwise you're not actually having a conversation. You're just scoring points for your audience.
Yeah.
And that's a fun game, but it doesn't lead anywhere.
No, well, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't resolve it. I mean, I think we're going to resolve anything that's happening. But it seems because, you know, it's a short-term thing, isn't it? But, like, people are not interested in experts or facts anymore. And that works, I think, as a short-term political thing. If you want your politics to succeed, you can ignore facts and you can ignore scientists and you can ignore yeah. the truth. But you can't do that over the long term because it will... a society without facts and without scientists will a civilization will fold because someone else will have facts and truth behind their
yeah which
doing.
Is again this kind of house of cards attitude yeah. to the fact we've got these institutions that people died to build and they're flawed. Of course they're flawed, they're run by people, so you're like, well, actually it went wrong in this way, or actually it's not good enough dealing with this kind of person, as though that will collapse the whole idea of justice or the whole idea of a fair trial or the whole idea of any of these things that we value.
Yeah.
Like, those are things we should fight for, not against.
Yeah, good. It's hard to amusing, isn't it?
Sorry. This is why I'm not naturally a comedian.
No, but this show is we can do anything we like in this show.
Sorry.
There's only two more shows to go in here. Fuck them. Oh no, shit, I'm touring it. Let's
what I thought was a really great chat with someone on a plane, and after about an hour they were like, "You're pretty intense."
I think, but you know, it's good to hear. I think all the things you're saying is good to hear someone say them, because I think that element of you know, not being able to admit fallibility, but also just being able to have a conversation. We used to be able to. You used to be able to have a chat with someone who I fundamentally disagreed with, and not walk away thinking they were an idiot or that they defended me or that I had to be angry with them. And that now, so you know, and I don't think most people want that. I don't think most of us want to. For example, Brexit, which is going to dominate us for the rest of our lives. We want to find a solution to that here in the UK, most of us, and yet the people pushing either way, and being resilient and saying it has to be this way are not going to create the solution.
Yeah, I had this happen. I do occasional Q&As on my Instagram or with my podcast listeners, and somebody said, my father is a Republican. They were in America. My father is a Republican. He has all these abhorrent views about abortion and so on and so forth. I like him, we get on really well, I love him dearly, he's my father, but I feel like I should cut him out of my life
right.
because he has these abhorrent political views. And I was like, is he a powerful politician? Because if he isn't, then all that matters is how he treats the people around him. Like, yeah. It doesn't matter. Why does it matter? He's not a celebrity, he's not a powerful figure, he's just your dad and an idiot. That's allowed?
Yeah.
Surely that has to be allowed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, even if it's not allowed, you have to negotiate life through these people. You're not going to make those people completely change their mind. You're probably not going to change your parents' minds at this late stage.
You're certainly not going to change it by burning down the relationship.
No. So, you know, but you've got to negotiate and navigate a way through all of this. That's what we have to do with the world at the moment, which is what we're not doing. Anyway, let's ask you a stupid question about something. What is the largest animal? You're from Australia, so this is going to work. What's the largest animal that's ever bitten you?
I have been pleasantly nibbled by an elephant, and weirdly, kangaroos always try to eat my hair.
Do they?
Kangaroos and wallabies go straight. I assume it looks like some sort of native grass, but they genuinely, every time I've ever come within arm's reach, tiny arm's reach of a kangaroo or a wallaby, they will just...
And are there just kangaroos and wallabies in Australia just walking around in the street, or do you have to go and find them to...
You have to go out of the middle of the city. Okay. You have to go into sort of... there's national parks that ring Sydney, which is my hometown, and if you go out into them, you'll see one. They're quite shy as a general rule, but...
I miss that. I wish humans hadn't destroyed the giant kangaroos. That's what I would like to... I'd like to go to Australia and see the original animals that were there before we turned up.
Oh, those massive wombats.
Yeah.
You know, wombats, only animal that does a square poo. They have a little, like little Lego blocks. They're very cute.
Yeah, my son can have a crack at that. Not this morning. It wasn't. It was very formless and shapeless this morning, and up his back. Horrible things. Horrible things. Children, don't have any children. Do not have any. It's bad for the environment. Don't do it. And also, they got the chill everywhere.
Just when they're 18, have them hand out 1,000 condoms, and they come out at a net loss.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, that could work. That's a good point. And what's the biggest animal you've bitten?
The biggest animal. I don't know that I've bitten any big animals. No. I once.
Have you bitten any small ones? It doesn't have to be big. It just has to be the biggest.
I accidentally ate a cockroach with my breakfast cereal.
Whoa.
Because I grew up in this very crumbly old mansion, a house that was falling to pieces, and we were a Buddhist family.
Yeah.
So we weren't allowed to kill any of these little creatures.
Wow.
So they would turn up in odd places. Do you know how arrogant a cockroach becomes if it knows you're not going to try and kill it? Like, fucking just...
And did you swallow the cockroach? Did it come out the other end okay? Because they can survive anything, can't they?
No, I spat it out, horrified, and sort of did
next time, swallow it and see what happens, and then...
Did that. Dance.
It is pretty nasty, a cockroach.
They don't taste good.
No.
Let me assure you.
But won't we all be eating insects quite soon? Isn't cockroaches one of the things we're meant to eat?
Yes, I think they're probably very high in protein or something disgusting like that.
Yeah. But I'm going to try and eat one. I bet you've got a good answer to the museum art gallery question. If you could have one item from any art gallery or museum that's yours and you can take it home and keep it in the whole world, which item would you take to own?
To own, yeah. Not to sell on?
You can sell on, it's yours, and then you can do what you like with it.
Look, if it was just to enjoy for myself, there used to be an incredible installation at the Melbourne Art Gallery that was just a pool, sort of turquoise bottom, and it had just cheap bowls floating in it and a convection current that banged them against each other with this sort of beautiful gong noise, and I used to just go and sit there, and it was like so relaxing and so nice. I'd have that.
I reckon you could knock one of those up in your own house.
Probably, but I am desperately lazy. So that or, you know, some sort of fancy crown.
A crown would be a good choice. I haven't thought of a crown. There's lots of stuff at the Tower of London that would be really cool to take.
One of those colonially thieved diamonds that are the size of your fist, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be quite nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, just a little nest egg to fall back on.
Yeah.
Imagine owning like a thousand of those. I mean, imagine owning all of the crown jewels. And just think, I've still got that there. They could do. Why don't they just sell the crown?
I imagine the Queen thinks that all the time.
Why don't they just sell like a couple of the crown jewels, and then we could sort out all the rest of the country?
Yes, they could do that, but they won't.
Why don't they just sell a couple of palaces and a couple of the crown jewels? A couple of the.
Why don't we just dismantle the monarchy and redistribute the wealth?
There's people in America
who just set up a little guillotine in Trafalgar Square, just a little one.
I'm just putting the idea out there. It doesn't seem fair. They've got all that stuff.
Not even big enough for heads, just a circumcision guillotine.
I think I'd take the stone of Scudin and I'd put it in my chair at home under my chair and sit on it. That's what I would do. Yeah. So we've nearly run out of time. It's been very good fun messing around with you and talking seriously with you. Tell us about your show and where it's on.
Oh, I have so many shows. So my show here at the Edinburgh Fringe is called Mythos. It's at the Gilded Balloon at 8:45. I'm also doing Savage, which is the show that means the most to me in the world, as a special in Melbourne on the 10th of September. So I'm doing it at the Yotel at 7 p.m. on Saturday the 24th. It's free to get in. And free to get out, even.
It costs these people quite a lot to get there. I have to say, the people in the room, but it could be worth it.
It could be worth it. So if you want to come to that, it's 7 p.m. on Saturday, and also I'm doing it in London on the 29th of September at the Museum of Comedy.
Brilliant.
So juggling multiple shows.
So you're going like back to Australia in in between those two shows. That's quite a short period of time.
So on the 10th of September, I'm filming this for a very fancy and a special occasion, which I'm not allowed to tell you who it is, but it's very fancy.
Okay.
And
is it Prince Andrew? Is it for Prince Andrew?
It is absolutely not. But don't get me started on Cardinal Pell. But I'm very excited to do it. But I've decided to do an old show rather than my new show, and it's mildly stressing me out because it's a show that means a lot to me. And all of a sudden, I was like, "That's why I should do it," and now I'm like, "That's why I should never have decided to do it."
It'll be great. It will be fantastic, ladies and gentlemen. Give a massive round of applause for the amazing Alex Fraser. Listen to our podcast; they're great as well. Thank you so much for coming along. Love to see you. Thank you. We've got three more of these. Who have we got tomorrow? We have George Egg on tomorrow and someone else. We've got Callie Beaton, I think it is. And we've got Tom Tuck and Tom Rosenthal from Friday Night Dinner on Saturday. And we've got Flo and Joan and John Kearns on Sunday, who are all fantastic acts. And there are tickets for all of those shows. You can definitely get in if you want to come. And I'll be touring this show in the autumn as well. If you are listening at home, go to show.com/gigs and you can find out about that. Thank you very much. I'll see you at the back if you're interested. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa at the Edinburgh Fringe with me, Richard Herring. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. Thank you to everyone at the Newtown Theatre and The Stand, and everyone at GoFasterStrike.com. The producer is James Hingley. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Go to rahulastapa.co.uk to find out more. RichardHerring.com/gigs to find out who my guests are for the rest of the run.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStrike.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show if enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.